This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Explosive accusations are shaking up the campaign for the corner office here in Massachusetts. Independent candidate Tim Cahill alleges a conspiracy by his former campaign aides to sabotage his candidacy.
What they're doing is wrong, not only for this campaign, but for the state of Massachusetts. I'm trying to talk to people about jobs. I'm trying to talk to people about the economy and give them a reason to vote for me. And they're trying to play every dirty trick in the book.
Yesterday, a judge granted Cahill's request that his former aides be prevented from sharing any campaign information with the Republican candidate, Charlie Baker. And in court filings, the Cahill campaign released what it said were email exchanges that prove that his former aides were plotting against him even before they quit his campaign. Cahill says they arranged for his running mate, Paul Lascoco, to abandon him and to instead endorse Baker, his rival. And Cahill told WBUR's Fred Tice yesterday how all this came to light.
We were doing some cleaning up of our server and realized that these emails existed, and they continued to exist even after these folks left the campaign.
Wait, so they had left and they were still communicating through your server?
Yes. Okay. Up until a few hours ago today.
Joining us now to talk about these allegations is Tim Cahill, the independent candidate for governor. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Mr. Cahill.
Thank you, Sasha.
So obviously, this has been a dramatic couple of weeks for you. Several campaign aides quit. Then Paul Lascoco, your running mate, defects over to the Baker campaign. Now these latest revelations. Can you give us a broad overview about why you decided to take this sort of high drama step to file a lawsuit?
Well, I'm just tired of playing defense with these accusations, with the RGA, the Republican Governors Association, with the Baker camp, and now with people who used to work for me, that they are playing an underhanded game of politics that I think is unprecedented, even for Massachusetts, and the people deserve better than that. So I'm just tired of them taking what may not even be the truth and twisting it for their reasons and for their end games. And I wanted to bring, you know, that out into the open. People need to know who we are as candidates, what we'll fight for, what we'll stand for, what we won't stand for. I wouldn't stand for this kind of politicking. That's why those guys left, because I wouldn't agree to their strategy of attacking Charlie Baker or attacking Deval Patrick with negative ads like have been hurled against me. And I won't stand for that, and I don't think the people of Massachusetts should stand for it either.
So you say you and they split on how to approach this campaign, whether negatively or positively, basically.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah, they chose to leave, but it's because we would not follow their advice, which is the advice that it appears that Baker is happily following and has been following really since back in May when the RGA came to his defense and started running attack ads against me, and they have continued right up until today.
Tim Cahill, Adam Meldrum, of course, was your former campaign manager. He's one of the people that quit about 2 weeks ago today.
Yep.
And now he's one of the people you're suing. Now, he says that the reason you're suing him is that he was going to be a whistleblower that said that you were misusing taxpayer money for your campaign as part of your capacity as state treasurer, and that this lawsuit is meant to basically deflect or be to attract attention away from that. What's your response to that?
Absolutely a false, absolute lie, and it's consistent with everything that the RGA and the Baker people have used against me. They're talking. They are really one campaign now. And they should stop the pretense that they're two separate organizations, because the same message that Adam Meldrum gave yesterday is the same message that Charlie Baker gave yesterday, is the same message that the Republican GOP party gave today. It is unfounded. There is no evidence of it. It did not happen.
So you're saying
they're trying to deflect away from what they did and what we have proof of what they did and what the judge agreed that the proof was substantial enough for them to have to stop doing it. What they do have of mine is email addresses, fundraising information, strategy memos, polling data that they can feed to Charlie Baker if they choose to do that. And it appears that there is some collusion there, that they were intending to do that. And that's what I call for a stop. We're not trying to hide anything. In fact, we've been very open with the media. We've released these emails that show these charges. And if we were afraid of them, we wouldn't have released them.
So, Tim Cahill, to clarify, you say that it is not true that in any way, in your capacity as state treasurer, you have misused taxpayer money to fund your campaign.
No, never. Never have, never will. This is about an honest campaign that is being straight with the voters. I've got a great record as treasurer. They've tried to misrepresent that record and actually lie about it on continuous times. I don't believe anything that comes out of that campaign, because nothing that has come out even before Melder and those guys left was anything close to the truth.
Tim Cahill, you have said numerous times in the past 2 weeks that no matter what happens, you're in this race till the end. Do you still think you have a viable candidacy given what's happened in the past few days?
Maybe more so. And I don't know if that's, you know, that's out there or that's just something I'm feeling, but maybe more so. We have lifted a shield that has existed in this two-party system for years about how these campaigns are waged and how they're sometimes won and how they're sometimes lost. And I think people, although it's, you know, it's not a happy circumstance for people to see it, they need to see it. They need to know whether they can trust their leaders here in the state, not just, you know, when they're running for office, because if you can't trust someone when they're running for office, how are you going to trust them after they've been elected?
One last question. You of course, had been a member of the Democratic Party. You're now, yep. You're now an independent. You're running as an independent. Many of your aides, Lascoco, your former running mate, these operatives who've quit, these were former Republicans, including yep. people who had worked for McCain. Do you regret having brought Republicans in to help you?
Hindsight is 20/20 in that case. I tried my best to create a bipartisan ticket. I'm not going to give up on the idea of bringing Republicans and Democrats together. I will be more careful as to which Republicans I bring in, but I'm not going to paint all Republicans with this broad brush that these folks have shown me. I haven't lost my faith in people. I haven't lost my faith in individuals who are part of a party or those people who have chosen not to be part of a party. So you learn in this business, and you often learn more by making mistakes in terms of who you choose to be with you, but it hasn't changed my faith in this business, but it will make me more careful in terms of which people I bring in. But from the beginning, it's been about bringing a difference to this state, a new approach, an approach that's going to solve problems, not make them worse. And I'll continue to fight that fight, and I hope the people of Massachusetts give me an opportunity to fight that fight for the next 4 years.
Tim Cahill, thank you for taking time out of your day and talking to us. We appreciate it.
You're welcome, Sasha. You're welcome.
Tim Cahill is the independent candidate for governor in Massachusetts. I want to note that we invited Charlie Baker to be on the show today, but he declined. While the charges made by Cahill are directed mostly at his former campaign aides, Cahill has called on Republican Charlie Baker to fire any of his campaign staff members involved in what Cahill calls this backroom dealing. Charlie Baker did have his own news conference today, and WBUR's Fred Tice was there, and he joins us now on the line. Hi, Fred.
Hey, Sasha.
Fred, what did Baker say to respond to all these allegations from Cahill?
He says there's been no communication between his campaign and the Cahill campaign about getting any secrets from the Cahill campaign. He says that people on his staff did not try to get any information from the Cahill campaign, and he says that they have not received any information. What seems to be going on here is that the Scott Meldrum, the former campaign manager, offered information through Paul Lascoco's associate, Jason Zanetti, and Zanetti then had communications with the campaign manager for Baker.
This is Tim O'Brien.
Yeah, Tim O'Brien, and basically said that they had information that they wanted to offer about improprieties involving the lottery and campaign staff on Tim Cahill's campaign. And what Baker said today was that we hear these rumors all the time. They were not going to go with any kinds of rumors. And so they demanded that evidence be provided if they were going to run with anything. And no evidence was ever provided of any improprieties on Cahill's campaign.
So, Fred, to clarify one thing, you said at the beginning that Baker said there was no communication between his campaign and Cahill's people. But one of Cahill's former running mates' people contacted Charlie Baker's campaign. And Baker is saying, they contacted us, but we didn't do anything with that because we didn't think it was valid. Is that the idea?
Yeah, that seems to be exactly what's going on if you piece together what Baker said in public today and what his staff is saying.
So Baker claims that the lawsuit Tim Cahill filed is just a distraction from allegations that were about to come out saying that Cahill improperly used taxpayer money through his job as state treasurer to help his campaign. Now, we just heard Tim Cahill say that that is absolutely not true. Did Baker offer evidence today that it is true?
No, because he says he never received that evidence, right? His campaign asked for proof when they were approached, and the proof was never provided.
Okay. Fred, thank you very much for filling us in on that, and I'm sure you'll be doing more reporting in the next few days, and maybe we'll talk to you more. We appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome, Sasha.
Thanks a lot. Joining us now to talk about all of this and the other big political news of the week is Peter Kanellis, who's the editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. Peter, thanks for being here again.
Thanks, Sasha.
And also Craig Sandler, who's the owner and publisher of the State House News Service. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Craig.
Thanks.
So, Peter and Craig, this has been quite a week, obviously. I'm wondering if either of you can remember a time in Massachusetts politics, which has been very colorful and lively over the years, when anything quite this explosive happened so close to Election Day.
Not this close, and also not this quickly, and perhaps not at this level of complexity. If, you know, I'm kind of rooting for everything to be true, everything involved to be true, just for the greatest level of spectacle.
Just because reporters love this stuff?
You know, it's the truth. I got to be honest. But on the other hand,
it's serious. It's people who make our legislative decisions in the state.
Absolutely. And to get serious for a second, by the way, looking at it just at very close range, you know, it occurs to me, particularly hearing this recounting just now, that, you know, most of the stories we cover, particularly when they get complicated, are not black and white. And usually everybody is a little right and a little wrong. And I'll bet you it sounds very much like that's what's going on here.
And Peter Kanellis, your take on this?
Well, I don't want to sort of self-righteously take the high road or anything on this, but I actually think that we were sort of getting to a place in the campaign where both Deval Patrick and Charlie Baker have very compelling, very well-articulated messages that are, you know, genuinely different and provide a genuinely clear choice. And so I think that this is a bit of a distraction, and perhaps at the end of the campaign when we look back on it, it'll be a distraction, and, you know, Charlie Baker will have won or lost based on, you know, his platform and his personality and whether people feel like the state is in disarray, and Deval Patrick would have won or lost for a various set of reasons, and we won't really be thinking about this.
So, Peter, you think it could blow over and issues prevail?
Yeah, I think it can blow over. I think that, you know, there's the justice in this is that, you know, it will give people a chance to maybe take another look at Tim Cahill or to assess his candidacy a little bit more on the merits. I think that people recognized right away that the Los Coco defection was kind of dirty pool, and this gives it even more of an air of kind of confirmed dirty pool. And so people will, you know, be naturally sympathetic to Cahill. They'll accept the legitimacy of his position in the race, take a look at him. But I don't think that this is either the beginning of a big, you know, advancement for Tim Cahill or the end of Charlie Baker. I think it's an episode, certainly, and it could impact Baker perhaps a little bit negatively, and it certainly diminishes any impact that the Los Coco defection might have had either to hurt Cahill or to promote Baker. But you know, we'll march on. And in the end, I suspect Patrick or Baker's vision will prevail.
Listeners, we're taking calls while we're talking about this, and we want to know what you think about all this turn of events. Tim Cahill filing a lawsuit saying that his former aides have tried to sabotage him. Does it make you feel more disgusted with politics? Do you feel like you've seen it all before? Has it changed the way you plan to vote, or maybe do you plan to not vote? We want to know what you think. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Craig and Peter, I wonder if we can try to talk in detail about what you expect to see out of the candidates in the next few days to try to deal with this. So maybe we can break it down and talk first about, for the Cahill campaign, how does this unfold in the next few days? And, of course, a court case is also unfolding. Mm-hmm. So that's one track. What do you think – let's start with you, Craig. What do you think you're going to see Cahill doing in the next few days to deal with this?
Well, I mean, obviously, if he really means it about, you know, the desire to be positive – he will get away from questions about the lawsuit and try to steer things back towards his vision for the Commonwealth and helping its people. I don't actually think that's what he's going to do, because I think that, while I think that Peter's right, you know, these things come and go as explosive as they are, and it is still far enough out that we could get refocused on the race. However, I do think that it does do Charlie Baker some small to medium amount of damage for an unknowable amount of time. And to that extent, I think the Cahill will probably be focused on the victory, the only victory he's likely now to win in this race, which is to defeat Baker. And the lawsuit can actually accomplish that goal.
Peter Kanellis, so now Tim Cahill is down a campaign manager, he's down a running mate, he's down aides. What does he do when he sits down with the people that are left the next few days?
Well, I think he's going to sort of try to make a plus out of his going it alone spirit. I think you'll see him out there probably with more of an exuberant smile, with a lot of people there saying, you know, hey, you've been treated badly by the system. You're a good guy. You deserve better. And him kind of appearing very buoyed by this new support. That's what I'd expect from Cahill for the next few days.
Let's talk the Baker campaign. And Craig, mm-hmm. start with you. As they sit at the table this weekend, this holiday weekend, which is not going to be much of a holiday for the Baker campaign, what do they do to remedy this?
Well, you know, I think what, in a sense, you know, if I were sitting there with them, they would talk about what perhaps this whole episode, you know, this, what I'm trying to say is that this whole episode could possibly get them focused where they really should have been all along. It could be the best thing that happened to Baker, because finally, I think it's going to require them to focus on Deval Patrick and his record and what he hasn't done. You know, we've been waiting for a long time for Baker to say something that causes people to really, you know, feel motivated or passionate about the ambiguity, the ambivalence they feel towards Deval Patrick. He really hasn't done that too successfully up till now, and he's going to want to get away from this distraction, this lawsuit, and back onto Patrick as quickly as possible. That's what I'd be encouraging him to do, and that's hopefully I would expect that's what they're going to be encouraging him to do.
Peter Kanellis of the Boston Globe, do you think that Charlie Baker can afford to just focus on Deval Patrick now, when he has this Tim Cahill problem on his hands?
Well, I think it depends on a couple of things. It depends on if there are any more revelations. I mean, this is the kind of situation where something could come out that would, you know, cast Baker's credibility in doubt, or some further evidence of communications between either Los Coco or Los Coco's aides and either O'Brien or the Baker people, or between the Baker people and the Republican Governors Association or something like that. And it does have the potential to become a morass. And so I certainly agree that Baker's going to try to step out of it as quickly as possible. And the best way to step out of it is to really focus on Patrick and pretend Cahill's not there. Baker's probably made a mistake focusing so much on Cahill.
That's right.
And I think that's what Baker's going to try to do, but whether he can do it or not is still a little in doubt.
Before we talk about how this affects the Deval Patrick campaign, which is the one sort of watching on the sidelines, I want to bring in a caller from Lunenburg. This is Louis from Lunenburg. Louis, what do you think about all this?
Well, I feel that it's a distraction. What we're trying to do here is we're trying to elect public servants who we feel are going to, do the best they can, for our society in this democratic country that we live in. And so it's really disconcerting when so much attention gets focused on, well, negativity, but then also what seems like people are more interested in grasping power than they are in serving the Commonwealth, you know. And that's my comment.
Thanks for that, Louis. So, Craig and Peter, briefly, of course, this gets at voter reaction. You know, some people feel disgusted. They may feel so disgusted that they don't just change their mind about who they vote for. They may think, I'm not going to vote. And then that potentially hurts Deval Patrick, who maybe could have benefited from all this. So what do the two of you think about how this plays out with voters?
Well, you know, again, I think that it is an opportunity for Baker to start talking about the issues very forcefully, to attack Patrick and his record legitimately, and to get the campaign where Louis would really like to see Louis and a lot of other people. But, you know, in a way, it's not just an opportunity. In some ways, you could think of it as Baker's responsibility, to get this campaign focused in that direction.
And Peter Kanellis, do you think we may actually see lower voter turnout because of a disgust factor about this?
Well, I think that there've been studies in the past that have shown that, you know, all this negative campaigning and focus on negativity and things that aren't, you know, productive issues does discourage voter turnout. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether that would help or hurt Deval Patrick, because a lot of the people who are, you know, who Charlie Baker's counting on are kind of independent voters, you know, time for a change. They're going to be rushing out to the polls. And, you know, some of them may feel a little chafed by this, too. So, you were mentioning Deval Patrick, though, before. I think Patrick actually looks pretty good. I mean, you know, we've seen a kind of personality contrast developing between Patrick and Charlie Baker. Patrick is, you know, really almost self-consciously trying to be the nice guy, the quiet guy, the productive guy, the respectful person. And Baker's been, you know, had a much rougher edge. And to the extent that that rougher edge begins to feel strategic rather than, you know, principled in going after, you know, important state issues, it hurts Baker and helps Patrick.
And Craig, your take on how this affects Deval Patrick, who's largely sat on the sidelines. I wonder if you feel that is that the best move, stay away from this, or does he need to jump in some way?
Well, there are a number of races, some of the congressional races, some of the other constitutional offices, where it's just very problematic to figure out whether Massachusetts is one of the truly angry states. You know, we saw Scott Brown get elected here. One of the truly angry states where the Tea Party, for example, has a lot of traction. In that case, staying on the sidelines is not going to help Patrick. And I think that to the degree, you know, people are ticked off about the way politics and policy is going in this country, they will still turn out to vote for Baker to get Patrick out of there. So it could be a mistake. Having said that, I think that one of the reasons that Tim Cahill is filing his lawsuit is that he's really still a Democrat, especially now. And so I think that to some degree, you know, he's implementing that, you know, pursuing those basic instincts.
Craig and Peter, we have to take a brief break, but you're still going to be with us after the break because we want to talk about more news in politics, including Suzanne Bump, the candidate for state auditor, claiming two primary residences for tax purposes, and then Congressman John Tierney, who has claimed that he knew nothing about his wife's tax evasion scheme to help her brother. So listeners, we'll still be taking calls. Give us a call after the break if you want to talk about Suzanne Bump or John Tierney. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Stay with us. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. We're talking about Massachusetts politics, and you can call us to chime in. We're going to be talking about the candidate for state auditor who's claimed two primary residences. We're going to be talking about Congressman John Tierney, whose wife pled guilty to tax charges this week. Call us if you want to weigh in on this. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Peter Kanellis and Craig Sandler, let's go on to Suzanne Bump. She, of course, is the former labor secretary in the Deval Patrick administration, who's now the Democrat running for state auditor. The Boston Globe this week published a story based on an investigation in which it found that she and her husband have been claiming property tax exemptions on both a house they own in the Berkshires in Great Barrington and a condo they own in South Boston. Now, typically you can only claim one exemption, but she'd been claiming two. And the exemption is supposed to apply to the house that is your primary residence. Every expert who weighed in the Globe story, and there were several, said you cannot have two primary residences. Bump has been saying, well, one is my principal residence and one is my primary residence, and I can claim both of them. And she insists that she's within the letter and the spirit of the law. Peter Kanellis, how about you first, since the Globe wrote this story? Do you think that even though every assessing expert that the Globe talked to says you can't do it, that she actually might have a point here?
Well, she has a point in a legalistic way. She says that Great Barrington judges whether it's your primary residence or not based on whether you vote there, while Boston does whether, you know, I forget what was Boston's thing? Boston was whether you pay taxes from there. So in Boston, she pays her taxes. In Great Barrington, she votes. So she's sort of within the letter of the law in both places. But look, the spirit of the law for sure is you can't live in two places. You have to have one primary residence and one secondary residence. And, you know, she would have gained a lot by just acknowledging that.
Yes, sir.
Craig seconds that. Suzanne Bump has since said that she received, quote, verbal confirmation, end quote, from municipal officials in both Boston and in Great Barrington that she was entitled to the tax exemptions. And here she is talking to WCVB Channel 5.
What they're concerned about in Boston is, are you an absentee landlord? And we are not, because we occupy the unit that we own.
And, of course, her point is that the reason people get property tax exemptions is essentially to encourage people to live in homes they own because they typically get taken better care of.
Right.
And you know, Peter, it may be the case that Suzanne Bump is eligible for exemptions in both towns, but isn't the question whether or not she's eligible for both of them simultaneously?
Yeah, I think that is the question. And frankly, if she had said something like, you know, we've been moving back and forth because of my husband's work, which I think she has said at some point, and, you know, inadvertently we didn't notify Great Barrington that we were doing this, and it's a $300 tax that I failed to pay, and I'm very sorry about it, I'm paying it, I think it would have gone away a lot more quickly than having this elaborate explanation. You know, but when people are dealing with their own personal business, it probably matters a lot to her to really show that this was not an oversight. oversight that she was doing everything correctly, especially given she's running for auditor. Mm-hmm. So it's become a longer controversy, and it's kind of in danger of defining her candidacy.
And Craig Sandler, as Peter Kennell says, Suzanne Bump has essentially dug in on this one, although she has now said that she's written the city of Boston a check for $6,000, which is what she saved over the years from this exemption, and that she wants the money back if she's proven right. Do you think that paying that check is sort of her preparing herself for being wrong?
It has shades of it never happened, and anyway, it was a long time ago, which we've seen before. I think that people who are going to, paying attention to the auditor's race and are going to cast any kind of knowledgeable vote are going to be disturbed by a few things. To the Globe's credit, and it's been reported that she got the verbal assurance from Greg Barrington from a brand new assessor who's now on vacation, and the old one said you had the policy clearly that it wasn't proper. That's a big problem for her, I think, for people who are really voting in this race. Another problem is a Republican opponent who's attractive, known for fighting on the big dig, and she knows how to make hay of this. It's going to be interesting to see this race.
And Republican opponent is?
Mary Connaughton, the former Turnpike board member, who made a splash for herself in ways that, are drawing voters to her campaign, especially independents, especially Tea Parties. And then the third thing, of course, is that when you go to vote for auditor, particularly when the other one's, been in office for 26 years, correct my math, ironically, you'd want somebody who's really good at keeping his or her financial affair is spotless.
It's the auditor.
Precisely. If she can't keep her money in order, letter of the law or not, how is she going to do that for us?
We have a caller who wants to weigh in. This is Ron from the South End. And Ron, what do you think about this? Suzanne Bump's... Oh, I'm sorry. We thought we had Ron. We've lost Ron. So let's move on to another issue that's been going on this week. And this has to do with the incumbent 6th District Congressman, John Tierney. He's been widely expected to easily defeat his Republican challenger, Bill Hudak. And then this week, Tierney's wife pleads guilty to tax fraud charges related to an illegal offshore gambling operation that her brother ran out of Antigua. And John Tierney claims he had no idea about his wife's dealings. She basically was helping him manage his money, as I understand it. She was out of his account helping pay medical bills and children's expenses, and she says she didn't know the money was illegal. Here is John Tierney at last night's debate hosted by Channel 25.
This is the 21st century, and what Patrice does with her family and family business is not something, as her husband, that I look over and monitor day to day on that or whatever. So I'm a little surprised at the question.
Peter Kanellis, that comment John Tierney made about the 21st century, he seems to be getting at what should the role of a woman and a man be in this century. He seems to be saying, do you think that a man should know all his wife's financial affairs? Is that how you read this? And do you think it's plausible Tierney couldn't have known?
Well, I think it's what he's trying to say. I think he said that he broadly knew that she had this bank account but didn't know all the details. I mean, his story has been just fuzzy enough to account for some, further revelations down the line. I think the thing that makes this significant, though, is the amount of money involved. It was a $7 million account, and also the extent of this illegal gambling operation that involved many, many of his wife's family members, her son from a previous marriage, two of her brothers. It feels like a very elaborate scheme. The brother who's in Antigua had been indicted here in Massachusetts for illegal gaming at one point. The wife says she didn't ask the right questions, but meanwhile is drawing money out of the $7 million account for the benefit of the kids and the mother. It's a situation that requires, I think, a little more probing and questioning, and so Tierney should not try to deflect it simply by saying it's the 21st century. What's my wife? What are you bothering me about it for?
The debate last night between Tierney and his Republican challenger, Bill Hudak, got pretty heated. Let's listen to a portion of that.
With all due respect, this is all about you. This isn't about your wife. This is about the fact that it's holding you.
Well, I hope
you.
So, Bill. I hope I know you'd like to debate my wife and run against her family, but you're just not going to have that opportunity.
I know you don't. I know you
want
to hide everything.
And the fact of the matter is the issues in this race are... Yeah, the
if
issue
you want
is
to talk about where the $7 million
you want to abolish the Department
is,
of Education,
one sir, at a time,
and you said that over
time.
And over again.
Sir.
You want to get rid of financial reform.
Not true.
That's
you're
totally
lying.
Out of no. I'm
let me
quite,
call you a liar to your face.
You
if
go
you
ahead,
won't
but
you
know, all
chance.
People have to do is
wait
look at the facts and look
me,
at your website.
Gentlemen, excuse me.
Craig Sandler, is this another possible win in Congress for the Republican Party that the Democrats thought they had locked up?
Well, first of all, it sounds like a big loss for that moderator. Poor moderator.
Lost control.
Which happens. But in any case, I will certainly say that this message in a race this tight, with the polls indicating that the overall race is pretty close and that, You know, you can choose to believe internal polls or not from the Hudak side, but the fact is, defending yourself by saying people come on, especially against a populist candidate, defending yourself by saying people come on, it was only 7 million, and you know it is probably not the direction you want to go. Again, this campaign is one that feels a lot like Scott Brown, a lot like some of the other congressional campaigns we've seen nationwide this season, where it's really taken hold. And I'd have a lot of skepticism about it if, you know, we weren't seeing numbers indicating that this is a tight race. And those numbers were gathered before this story broke. So I think, there's cause for a real concern.
And Peter Kanellis?
I think it's a winnable race, but I think Craig is sort of mischaracterizing a little bit Tierney's response. I don't consider Tierney's response to be adequate, but he's not saying, hey, it's only $7 million. He never said that. And the other thing we saw in that clip or heard in that clip is that, you know, Hudak is potentially a problematic candidate. You know, he was saying, I'm calling you a liar to your face. It was an intemperate aspect to him. And then he's also the person who had the sign on his lawn comparing Obama to Osama bin Laden, with a caricature of Obama dressed as Osama bin Laden. He has apologized for that, and you don't judge somebody by one thing. But there's a sense of Hudak as a real unknown, and you know, that might, you know, mitigate some of the damage to Tierney.
In the time we have left, let's do our weekly tradition that we call the Friday Hubbub. This is the two of you mentioning a bit of information that piqued your interest this week. And Craig Sandler, let's start with you.
All right, then. Well, I mean, just from today, the state Senate did pass a long-delayed $400 million supplemental spending bill that became the focus of one of the constitutional races this year when Karen Pulido, running for treasurer, held it up for day after day in the House. The Republicans ran with that in the Senate and held it up for day after day in the Senate, got perhaps a window dressing amendment requiring the governor to provide more budget information later this year, and the bill finally went through. That's my story for this week, mostly because it indicates what still goes on in informal sessions.
Is this the bill that went through because she got stuck in traffic and wasn't there to block it? Isn't that how that unfolded?
Yes, ma'am. And then it was stuck for a few days in the Senate. But my real focus here is that a lot goes on in the building in informal sessions, and I consider it now my bounden duty to bring to future hubbubs this year more action in informal sessions, because you would be amazed at some of the stuff that's important that goes on.
And Peter Kanellis, what is your Friday hubbub?
My Friday hubbub was the story in the Globe last week about the fact that in 2009, CEOs in Massachusetts publicly chartered companies had an average of an 8% pay increase, even though this was 2009. This was the real economic meltdown year, which I think really points to the need for some curbs on CEO pay, and shareholders themselves are the best positioned people to do that.
And my Friday hubbub is basically to tamp down a rumor that started and got tamped down, but I want to clarify. Last week, someone tweeted that they had seen two big trees on the Boston Common cut down, and they said they were cut down because of Asian longhorn beetle infestation.
Uh-oh.
Now, that rumor spread very quickly that Asian longhorn beetles had showed up on the Boston Common. The city's parks department tweeted that the trees were removed only as part of routine work and not due to the Asian longhorn beetle. So I want to put out there that the city says no Asian longhorn beetles in the Boston Common.
Tweeting about trees, most appropriate.
Exactly. Thanks to both of my guests. Peter Kanellis is the editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, Sasha.
And Craig Sandler is the owner and publisher of the State House News Service. Thanks, Craig.
All right, a pleasure.
When we come back, Ben Mezrich has made a name for himself as the pop chronicler of brainy young students who strike it rich in fantastic ways. His latest book was the basis for the movie The Social Network about Facebook and its founder Mark Zuckerberg, and we'll be talking to him about that. Stay with us. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.